You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line.
And obviously we were very, very happy with the news. I don't think it sunk in until he was finally in the car with us and we were on the way to the house.
After 2,020 days, Palestinian political prisoner Dr. Sami Al-Aryan was released from prison this week in the custody of his daughter Layla. We'll speak to her about his release and what lies ahead. Also this week.
What was disturbing is what we kept hearing, specifically the repeated reference to Islamofascism, to Islamoradicals, to jihadists, without any context.
The third annual Washington-Israel Summit, sponsored by Christians United for Israel, was held in the nation's capital. Politicians, pundits, and preachers all joined in condemning Iran, the Palestinian resistance, and of course, Muslims. We'll speak to two journalists, Farah Hassan and Diedrich Muhammad, who attended the conference on what they saw and heard. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for August 30th through September 5th, 2008. Diplomatic efforts continue in a number of four capitals. While on the ground in Palestine, Israeli military forces continue their invasions in the West Bank areas, and more Palestinian patients lose their lives due to the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We start our weekly report with the non-violent actions in Palestine, where one Italian was wounded in Belayin's weekly protest on the first anniversary of the Israeli court ruling to change the route of the wall there. Meanwhile, Al-Masara village near Bethlehem is declared an Israeli goods-free village. E.L. Hamble with the details.
On Friday, one Italian human rights activist was wounded with rubber-coated steel bullets in the weekly non-violent anti-wall protest in the West Bank village of Belayin. Medical sources reported that the wounded activist was identified as Frederica, and her injury was described as moderate. The protesters marched after the Friday prayer from the mosque of the village to the construction site of the wall, where the Israeli troops were waiting for them. Local sources in Belayin said that the troops fired CS gas canisters and rubber-coated steel bullets in addition to the concussion grenades at the peaceful protesters. Dozens were exposed to the gas and treated for gas inhalation. Protesters carried Palestinian flags and signs demanding the immediate removal of the wall and the settlements, and the release of 11,000 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. As the protesters arrived at the gate in the built section of the wall, they managed to remove it from its place. However, the Israeli military declared the area a closed military zone to force the crowded Palestinian, Israeli, and international activists to leave the area. Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Belayin said that it had been a year since the Israeli High Court ruled to move the wall 500 meters away from the village, yet the court ruling was not implemented as of yet. The court's decision will not allow the village to retrieve around 300 acres of land grabbed for the construction of the wall, noting that the total area of land expropriated from the Belayin village is 600 acres. In Bethlehem, residents of the nearby El Masada village organized a nonviolent protest under the title, El Masada is Israeli Goods Free. The villagers were joined by the international peace activists and went through the village to the land slated for confiscation for the construction of the wall. Israeli troops stopped the protesters on their march before they could reach their destination, and the organizers spoke to the crowd from that spot. The speaker stressed the need for continuous nonviolent actions against the wall and the settlement until they stop, demanding the international human rights organizations to support this civic effort. On his part, Mohamed Blegier, one of the organizers of the protest, said another protest will be organized next Monday, during which protesters will burn Israeli goods in front of Israeli soldiers. For IMEMC, this is E.L. Humble.
Israeli military forces continue their invasions into the West Bank areas, taking a number of civilians prisoner. More details with IMEMC's Ghassan Banoura.
Early this week, the Israeli troops swept into the Jenin city, ransacking the house of a Palestinian family and taking members of the family for interrogation. Also, Israeli armored vehicles stormed a number of Palestinian cities, such as Jenin, Hebron, Bethlehem, and Tulkarem. Cities of Hebron and Bethlehem were invaded twice during the week. These invasions have resulted in the detention of several residents, including 7 in Tulkarem, 2 in Bethlehem, and 2 in Hebron. Israeli attacks on the West Bank areas take place on a daily basis. Also, an 18-month-old Palestinian toddler was in danger of dying after his arrival at a hospital was delayed by Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint. The toddler was reportedly suffocating after his tongue was turned back into his mouth. Israel has more than 570 checkpoints and roadblocks around the West Bank cities, towns, villages, and refugee camps, thus grossly impeding movement of the Palestinian population. In the meantime, an Israeli military court acquitted the Israeli soldiers who shot and killed a Palestinian resident of Na'alin village near Ramallah last month. The deceased man was shouting at a soldier who was arresting his brother. Another soldier shot him with 3 rubber-coated bullets. 2 penetrated his skull, while the third went into his chest. Apart from the Israeli attacks on the West Bank, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza confirmed that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank arrested 6 Hamas members this week. For IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
The number of Palestinian patients who died due to the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip stands at 245 this week. IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Hussein Abu Jazar, a 77-year-old man from the Gaza Strip, died this week after his access outside of Gaza was delayed due to the Israeli blockade on the coastal region. The death of Abu Jazar brought the death toll of ill patients to 245 since Israel imposed the siege in June 2007. This week, on the northern Gaza shores, Israeli naval vessels shot and wounded 2 Palestinian fishermen while on board their ships. The fishermen were accompanied by 5 international peace activists who are members of the Free Gaza Movement. In the meantime, early this week, Egypt reopened the Rafah crossing terminal for a couple of days, allowing hundreds of patients, stranded students and travelers in and out of Gaza. Member of the Free Gaza Movement, Lauren Booth, a British journalist, and sister-in-law of a Qatar's envoy, Mr. Tony Blair, was denied access to Egypt through the terminal. Booth and 8 other fellow members have been denied exit of Gaza, either through Egypt or through the Israeli checkpoint of Eretz in northern Gaza. These 9 internationals chose to stay in Gaza as their comrades of the Free Gaza boat, which broke the siege on August 23, returned back to Cyprus after spending 5 days in Gaza. Jamal al-Khudri, a Gaza lawmaker and head of the local popular committee to break the Israeli siege, confirmed that another boat will attempt to arrive in Gaza after September 22. Internationals stranded in Gaza will return back to Cyprus on this boat. For IMEMC.org, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and his Israeli counterpart Shimon Peres discussed in Italy outstanding political issues between the two sides as Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak hinted at the possibility of establishing a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem. IMEMC's Jessica Hasley has the details.
This week in Palestine, a meeting between Palestinian President Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Olmert resulted in no concrete progress in terms of Palestinian-Israeli peace talks. Top Palestinian negotiator Ahmed Koreya said that there will be no solution without occupied East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Later in the week, Israeli Defense Minister Barak stated to Al Jazeera that Israel will possibly allow Palestinian sovereignty over some Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. Barak's statement was slammed by the Minister of Transportation, Shaul Mofaz, who considered the statement as representing only Barak and not the official policy line of the Israeli state. Israel insists that Jerusalem should remain united under the Jewish state. As Palestinian-Israeli peace talks have virtually achieved no progress, Palestinian factions are currently meeting with Egyptian officials in Cairo for talks over Palestinian national unity. Underway, talks are aimed at getting the rival Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, closer in terms of ending their current split in Gaza and in the West Bank. Egypt's foreign minister, Ahmed Abulghait, was reported by the Middle East News Agency as proposing deployment of Arab forces in the Gaza Strip. The proposal was rejected by the ruling Hamas party and other parties in Gaza. The factions won't welcome such forces, but will rather deal with them as hostile troops, unless they are expected to liberate Jerusalem. Both Fatah and Hamas parties have been at odds since the Islamist Hamas took power after the January 2006 elections. Rivalry reached a climax when Hamas seized control of Gaza completely and ousted Fatah loyal forces from Gaza in June of 2007. Meanwhile, French President Nicolas Sarkozy delivered a message from the father of captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit to a Syrian counterpart, Bashar al-Assad, to be handed over later on the Damascus-based exile leader of Hamas. France has been putting forth efforts for the release of Shalit from Gaza, where Hamas has been holding the soldiers since June of 2006 due to cross-border attacks in southern Gaza. Shalit holds a dual French-Israeli citizenship. Since June 19, 2008, both Israel and the Palestinian factions have agreed to a ceasefire deal, brokered by Egypt, in which talks over the release of Shalit would resume. Hamas wants to see hundreds of Palestinian prisoners released, including those with long-term imprisonments. This week, Israeli Chief of Internal Security Avi Dichter said that Hamas obstructs the possibility of reaching an agreement over the Shalit case. Israel has pulled back on an agreement to release 70 Palestinian prisoners. For IMEMC.org, this is Jessica Holsey.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Hossam Qassis and George Shmawi.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. After 2,020 days, three hunger strikes, constant harassment from an overzealous prosecution, and gratuitous detention, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, released Dr. Sami Alarian, a noted professor and Palestinian political prisoner, on bond September 2, 2008. Joining us to talk about her father's recent release is Leila Alarian, a journalist who works for Al Jazeera English Network and contributes to The Nation magazine. Leila, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thank you, Najee.
Leila, first off, congratulations to you and your family. How excited were you all when you heard about your father being released? Did you know ahead of time, or did it just suddenly happen?
It was pretty much sudden. We got a phone call on Tuesday morning from our attorneys, basically saying that ICE, which is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, issued an order that my father be released that day. And obviously, we were very, very happy with the news. I don't think it sunk in until he was finally in the car with us and we were on the way to the house. And it's been 5.5 years of being apart, of visits behind glass, sometimes weeks and weeks without visits. And we had stretches of 6 months without phone calls at one point. So it was obviously a huge blessing to be able to be reunited after so long.
Your father is under house arrest until his trial begins. It's interesting to note that the last that we spoke about this whole bond was when your brother Abdullah was on the show, and he wasn't feeling confident about your father getting released because of the government's attempts to keep him incarcerated. Now that your father has been released, do his attorneys view this as a sign that finally the nightmare might come to an end, meaning just having him leave the country rather than going through another trial?
Well, I won't speak for his attorneys, but my assessment of it is that the government's case does seem to be falling apart. I mean, they never had a case to begin with, because what they're really trying to do here in Virginia is retry the Florida case that they lost so badly 2.5 years ago. So what they're doing is they're attempting to retry my father by trying to force him to testify in a completely separate case. Because my father said it was against both his plea agreement and his principles to do that, they then indict, not only held him in civil contempt for 12 months, they also charged him with criminal contempt, which is very unusual. A lot of lawyers say that it's very, very rare that someone would be first held in civil contempt and then charged with criminal contempt, basically meaning you're punishing someone twice for the same alleged crime. So It just shows that their tenacity and, you know, their insistence on trying to punish and torture him is failing, in the sense that, you know, they once called him, you know, a dangerous person or whatever the terms they used to slander him, and now he's a free man, essentially, in America, even though it is under home confinement. But it just shows that this case was political all along.
Leila, how is your father's health now that he is out? I remarked in my introduction that he had embarked on 3 very long hunger strikes. How is his health presently at the moment?
Well, his health is okay considering what he's been through, but he's had hernia for more than a year, maybe even close to 2 years, which the authorities never let him get treated for, even though more than one doctor said that it was necessary for him to have surgery. So what we're hoping and praying is that during this time that he's under home confinement, we can schedule finally a surgery, that after so long for a condition that's been really painful and uncomfortable for him, to get that treated at least. And as far as the rest of his health, you know, he's diabetic, so he's just trying to keep that under control and treated with medication.
Now, I know that you've been doing a number of interviews, as well as your brother Abdullah and other members of your family. Of course, your father at the moment has been advised by his attorneys not to comment in regards to specifics of the case. But have you known, has the government made any comments regarding the release of your father at all? Has there been any statement by them about their consternation to the decision by the judge?
No, we haven't seen anything from their side. And I think the most important comment is the one from the judge ruling or ordering that my father be released.
Now, it's interesting. You bring up this judge, and I've been researching her a little bit. I understand that when your judge was going to allow you to be the person that your father was going to be released under custody, a prosecutor who has been the bane of your family for quite a while, Gordon Kromberg, who has shown clearly that he has issues with Arabs as well as Muslims, stood up and had basically made a blatant sexist and racist statement. Am I not correct? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, this was a hearing in early August when we were discussing some of the pre-trial issues that are coming up in the upcoming trial. Basically, our lawyers were making some legal arguments about why the indictment should be dismissed and the charges should, actually it's only one charge, that the charge should be dropped. And in the course of that hearing, around the end of the hearing, our lawyer just stood up and told the judge basically that the custody of my father would be transferred from my older brother Abdullah, who just moved out of the apartment with his wife, into my custody. And the judge asked, she said okay, and she asked the prosecutor, Gordon Kromberg, if he had any objections. And he stood up and said, in this particular culture, meaning Arabs and Muslims, a woman can't stand up to her father and if he tried to leave. And it was, I mean, I could tell you, jaws dropped all over the courtroom. People were gasping. Everyone kind of turned around and looked at me, and they just could not believe what was said by a federal prosecutor, someone with that much power and authority in his hands. He just, he's known for these racist outbursts, and this is just one more case where he really couldn't help himself but have yet another outburst. And the judge, as a woman, and I think as a fair-minded human being, didn't let that stand, and she said, this is not only an insult to Dr. Alarian and his daughter, this is an insult to the court, and I'm the wrong judge to say this in front of. And it kind of ended on that note.
And with that, we are going to end it on that note. We have been speaking to Leila Alarian, a journalist with the Al Jazeera English Network and a contributor to The Nation magazine and daughter of the now bonded Palestinian political prisoner, Dr. Sami Alarian. And you can keep up to date on his case and other information at www.freesamialarian.com or check it out in our links section. Leila, as always, congratulations. Thank you to you and your family. And thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thanks, Najee. I really appreciate it.
Die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low, you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change? How bad, how good does it need to get? How many losses, how much regret? What chain reaction would cause an effect? Makes you turn around, makes you try to explain, makes you forgive and forget, makes you change.
Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. For 4 days in July, Christians United for Israel, or CUFI, held its third annual Washington-Israel Summit. During the conference, the question of Iran repeatedly was a topic of discussion. was such neocon notables like Gary Bauer, president of American Values, using somewhat mild language when he said, quote, "What do you do with a maniac like Ahmadinejad? I'm not sure diplomacy works," to the more blunt rhetoric of the Weekly Standard editor William Crystal, who urged attendees that they must continue to fear, quote, "Islamo-fascists, Islamo-radicals, and death worshippers," close quote. In addition to the usual suspects, members of Congress were also in attendance, including Representative Mike Pence, a Republican from Indiana, and Representative Elliot Engel, a Democrat from New York. The bipartisan drumbeats for a showdown with Iran come in the form of two resolutions, House Resolution 362 and Senate Resolution 580, call on the United States to prevent Iran from, quote, "acquiring a nuclear weapons capability through all appropriate economic, political, and diplomatic means," close quote. But the reality on the ground is Kufi would like to see the U.S. government move towards a more direct approach with Iran, similar to that which resulted in the quagmire in Iraq. Further, Kufi is committed to making the whole of Israel-Palestine a Jewish-only region and has been urging lawmakers to root out the so-called suicide bombers and haters of Israel. With us to talk more about this conference are two journalists who have a unique interest on what they saw and heard at the Kufi gathering. Diedrich Muhammad is the Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good, and Farah Hassan is the 2008 Carol Jean and Edward F. Newman Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. They are both contributors to Foreign Policy in Focus and Practicing Muslims. Diedrich Muhammad and Farah Hassan, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Hi, Salam. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for being with us. Farah, let's begin with you. In an article that you and Diedrich co-wrote titled "Christians United for Israel and Attacking Iran," you said that, quote, "As Muslims, we attended the summit to learn more about Kufi. What we found was disturbing," close quote. Can you talk a little bit more about this?
Yes, sure. That's exactly right. We heard about this conference. It was its third year going. I had seen a video made by The Nation writer Max Blumenthal, who's been tracking down John Hagee, Kufi, and Christian Zionists, and was purely motivated to go and see what was being said. And also, through studying U.S. Middle East policy, curious to know what kind of influence does Kufi exert. So for me, that was really what motivated myself and I believe my colleague as well, Diedrich, to attend this summit. And the thing is that in getting a press pass, in the minute we entered the conference, it wasn't that we felt that there were all eyes on us, you know, Diedrich and I, the two Muslims who stood out. We didn't get that sense at all. We were treated courteously by the Kufi staff on the one hand, but it also should be noted that we attended the only day that was open to the press, that we were advised to only stick to our area at this row in the back of the Middle East intelligence briefing. And so there was a sense that, of course, this was a tightly controlled event from the perspective of journalism and reporting about what happened. In the middle of the Middle East briefing with Gary Bauer, as you mentioned, and other speakers, including William Crystal, what was disturbing is what we kept hearing, specifically the repeated reference to Islamofascism, to Islamo-radicals, to jihadists, without any context. I mean, Gary Bauer opens up his remarks by frankly exploiting 9/11, by going back to that horrible day in September that would change the world. And what was so problematic is that as he was going back to that day, all of a sudden he was referring to Iran in the same sentence, as if Iran was responsible for 9/11. So right away it was problematic because there wasn't any context, because he was not only exploiting the fears of individuals attending the briefing by invoking the horrors of 9/11, but by conflating Iran when speaking of terrorism. So that was one of the disturbing things for me, anyhow.
And Dedrick, what about you? I noticed in your article you were talking about the only panel that you all were allowed to attend was the Rapture Meets the Clash of Civilization session. Can you talk a bit more about this session, and were you or Farah allowed to press the presenters with any poignant questions during any kind of Q&A?
Well, yeah, I mean, and the actual title of the session was a Middle East briefing. It seems like it was some mixture of the Rapture and the Clash of Civilizations, the ideology that was helped put forward by Samuel Huntington. To answer your last question, no, there was no possibility for us to really ask questions to the panelists. There was a very brief question and answer period at the end, with the first few questions coming from amongst the panel themselves. And so it was a time really just to observe. And I think, again, one of the most fascinating pieces of it was, this was a very tightly controlled media event, but even in this tightly controlled media event, how freely they felt to describe their enemy solely in terms of using different names for Muslims, whether it be death worshippers, Islamo-fascists, and never even bringing up the idea that maybe there are those in the Muslim community in which they could work with. And it was disturbing to see communities that have had some hostile relations in the past, evangelical Christians and pro-Zionist Jews, coming together around what it seemed to be a mutual fear and disdain for Muslims. And that's definitely felt disconcerting, to see people coming together around prejudices against the Muslim community.
Well, that's an interesting point to bring up. And Farah, I wanted to begin with you. In the past, the Reverend John Hagee, the co-founder of CUFI, has made very inflammatory remarks about Armageddon and the annihilation of the Jews. Most recently, comments he made about God sending Hitler to drive the Jews into Israel created a firestorm in the media, which forced Hagee to withdraw his support for Senator John McCain's presidency. Barring their views on Muslims and Islam, what was the reaction to attendees of the conference when you challenged them on Hagee's and other Christian Zionist ministers' comments concerning their anti-Semitic remarks about Jews?
Well, the thing is that we couldn't challenge that. I mean, when we went to the event, as Diedrich mentioned, at the end of the so-called Middle East intelligence briefing, there was prepared questions that David Brog, the CUFI DC lobbyist, asked the panelists, and that was that. There wasn't, you know, in terms of ahead of the conference, what is telling is that there were some folks like J Street, this group that calls itself a counter to AIPAC, that urged Senator Joe Lieberman not to attend the CUFI summit. Joe Lieberman was the guest of honor, the main speaker at the Night to Honor Israel event that occurred later that night, which unfortunately we didn't get to go to, so we can't report about that. But, I mean, it is curious, as Diedrich mentioned, that given John Hagee's inflammatory remarks and given belief of these Christian Zionists that after the second coming of Christ, Jews are required to convert to Christianity or else be left behind with the other quote-unquote non-believers, a.k.a. Muslims like myself, indeed, it is telling that a representative from AIPAC was still there, that Elliot Engel, a Jew, was still there. And this is the third conference that he's attended. So that actually does bring to mind several questions as to why such folks like Engel would continue to come. But, you know, the obvious answer being that he and others could unite against the common Muslim enemy, against Ahmadinejad, against Hamas,
and unite for a uncritical embrace of Israel.
Please.
And I think that is key. I think there's been a strategic alliance that feel that within the conservative Zionist community, Jewish Zionist community, that it is that any past prejudiced statements or even current prejudiced statements that has been said by some of these evangelical Christian ministers should be ignored for the greater good of creating stronger support for Israel.
Well, Dedrick, I wanted to ask you a specific question. In my own research dealing with Christians United for Israel and seeing reports by Bill Moyers as well as yourselves and others, I've noticed, especially within video footage, I've seen quite a high number of African Americans who are congregants of Hagee's Church, of Rod Parsley, of T.D. Jakes, Fred Price, and the others who are staunch Christian Zionists. Did you encounter African Americans here at this conference? Were you able to talk with them about their views towards this and see the relevance between especially Israel's policies towards Palestinians, which smack of Jim Crow, as well as apartheid South Africa? And if so, what was the response that you got?
At this particular conference, I didn't see a high amount of African Americans at the conference, so African Americans were clearly present. But in talking outside of this conference and talking to some and oftentimes it is black Christians who are the least political and really their only reference point to the Israel-Palestinian conflict is that of which their ministers are telling them. And the ministers are telling them, I've heard people say, well, Jews are the chosen people of God and we need to stand with God's people. And just leave it at that. Actually, a group of African American ministers who most recently had a paid trip to Israel to tour. And what they do is they utilize people's belief in the Bible, people's want to have a connection to the Holy Land, and also pay for trips to send people to tour the Holy Land, while at the same time getting briefings from Israeli security analysts, Israeli officials, as well as Israelis who have lost loved ones in battles with Palestinians to try to help push these the African American community and communities in general to be stronger supporters of Israel. And I think it's been frustrating as a whole because predominantly, the African American community has been one that has been much more supportive of the Palestinian people and of greater equality and justice in Israel and Palestine than most of the American public. But there is an ongoing, highly financed campaign to do so, and it's it is going to be a challenge when there isn't such a highly financed, a strong campaign to counter this radically pro-Israel kind of movement.
I wanted to try and get both your thoughts on this. Representative Elliot Engel, a Democrat from New York, was quoted in your article as saying, quote, "I don't think the U.S. needs to be even-handed in the Middle East. It needs to stand with and behind our only ally, Israel." What are your thoughts? Farah, let's begin with you.
Well, he wasn't the only one who said that at the conference. Unfortunately, we had to hear that repeatedly, not only from Engel, but even Mike Pence. And I had a couple thoughts. Number one, in all honesty, I laughed, not to disrespect the issue or the region, because I've traveled repeatedly to the Middle East, to Syria, to Saudi Arabia, to Egypt. But I laughed because simply I thought to myself, wow, as if Israel is the only country in the region, the only country with challenges, security, development, political, social, et cetera. And that precipitated the laugh. But then really, I thought about it again. And what's a bit disconcerting about that statement is that I've heard it before on the Hill. Yesterday when Barack Obama spoke at DNC, he mentioned the protection of Israel again. All other presidential aspirants have had to repeat a commitment to the security of Israel. In the DNC convention platform, it's there. Curiously absent, of course, is the protection of Israel's neighbors as well. And when you hear statements like this, that the U.S. only needs to stand behind our ally, Israel, it's no wonder that peace remains absent between Israel and her neighbors, frankly, and that position isn't constructive at all to resolving outstanding grievances between Israel and her neighbors, between ending the Israeli occupation of Palestine or the Israeli occupation of Syria's Golan Heights, or about resolving the conflict between the U.S. and Iran and Israel and Iran. So I found it first comical and then, frankly, disconcerting.
And what I found so amazing about that idea is that America must stop playing, must now stand behind Israel and not try to be even-handed. Is when was America even-handed? I mean, America has been giving billions of dollars to Israel and very little to Palestine, has always put forward Israeli security interests above and beyond anyone else's interest in that region. So the kind of myth that America has been playing an even-handed role and that now it must truly embrace Israel is scary, because if they're asking for a more radical call to stand by Israel, and it's just reconstructing history. I mean, I think the large problem in the Middle East is that there hasn't been efforts to really have even-handed policy where you can really bring together two sides. The United States has much power in Israel and could pressure Israel to abide by the kind of very basic and modest demand of allowing the West Bank and the Gaza Strip be some type of continuous independent state, and really allowing Israel to maintain the property that it took from the Palestinians decades ago. So just the idea that the United States is a balanced, even-handed partner in this Middle East negotiations is ridiculous on its face.
And on that note, already the perception in the Middle East is that the U.S. hasn't played an even-handed role in the region at all. So to hear this different narrative being offered at the conference by Elliot Engel and Mike Pence and the other speakers, again, for us, or at least for me, I don't want to speak for Diederik, but again, it felt, you know, that we were, you know, walking between two worlds, and what was offered at Kufi, frankly, veered from the facts on the ground, especially if you have been to the Middle East.
We're speaking with Farah Hassan, the 2008 Carol Jean and Edward P. Newman Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Diederik Mohammed, a Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. This is Crossing the Line. This is Crossing the Line, and our guests today are Farah Hassan and Diederik Mohammed. Diederik, House Resolution 362 and Senate Resolution 580, if both of these bills get out of committee and pass, what do you feel the impact will be in regards to Iran?
Well, I think right now I don't believe it'll lead to any immediate action in Iran right now, just because I believe the United States is still it's still fairly bogged down in Iraq. There's increasing problems in Afghanistan, increasing tensions with Russia. I think to embark upon another a foreign escapade of military intervention, I think is beyond even this administration, particularly as it's leaving office and has below 30% approval rating. But I do think it continues to solidify this perceived notion that Iran somehow is an enemy of the United States and must be treated as such. And that can have long-term effects, so that when, let's say, if a very bad situation occurs and John McCain is elected, it could further open the door for possible military intervention in the future.
Farah, I've had guests on this show before speaking about Kufi. Sarah Posner, author of God's Prophets, Reverend Thomas R., who is a recovering Christian Zionist and now is an active Palestinian advocate. and Professor Don Wagner, a professor at North Park University and an expert on Christian Zionism. They've all said that Christian Zionist influence is growing in the corridors of power, most notably during the Bush administration. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's telling, and this is citing Max Blumenthal, who's been doing an excellent job of covering Kufi's influence, particularly on U.S. Middle East policy. He mentioned that in the midst of the war between Hezbollah and Israel in the summer of 2006, that the White House was meeting with individuals from Kufi, and that more tellingly, they pressed White House officials to not only adopt a more aggressive posture towards Iran, but to refuse aid to Palestinians, to give Israel a freer hand as it was revving up its conflict with Hezbollah in the midst of the war. And I think it's also telling, and I don't think coincidental, that many of the policies of neoconservatives within the Bush administration, including isolating Hamas, of nixing the possibility of peace between Israel and her Arab neighbors, those policies are, frankly, have been embraced and advocated by members of Kufi as well. So, of course, many people point to the AIPAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and its influence on the Hill. But likewise, I think Christian Zionists and their ability to organize, they also have a significant impact on crafting U.S. Middle East policy. And that's why I think one point that Diedrich and I wanted to emphasize in our article is whatever you think about the beliefs of Hagee and Christian Zionists, if a lot of people, the first word comes to mind is kooky. But frankly, what isn't kooky is to dismiss their growing influence on U.S. Middle East policy.
Diedrich, how did attendees feel? And I'm not saying if you asked them directly, but if you might have overheard or if you had asked them, how did they feel about Bush's Annapolis summit, the so-called Gaza pullout that happened when Ariel Sharon was still prime minister, and the ongoing tepid meetings between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas?
You see, I think it's not even so much a focus of what these individuals, the individuals in the audience feel, but really the people on stage. Because what you have when you kind of conflate, when you bring this evangelical Christian movement into the political realm, is, you know, generally the church is not a place where everybody has their own opinions and is discussed. It's a place where the pastor brings forth the word of God and the people sitting in the audience hear that, listen to that, and then try to follow it. And I think, again, that is a subtle distinction of what is happening at these conferences that are now political in nature, but they still kind of have an overall theological framework, and people are still receiving these ideas not so much as different political opinions, but as manifest words of God, which then they should just follow and support. And so I think what we have seen is that the leadership has become, the Christian evangelical leadership has become much more reactionarily supportive of Israel. So now any discussion of peace between Israel and Palestinians is now looked at as betraying Israel. While I think just 10 years ago, there was an idea that discussion of peace between Israel and Palestinians was something that could be supportive of Israel. I think now we're getting to the point where, no, anything but total dominance by Israel, any type of settlement or negotiation that Israel is asked to go through is betraying Israel. So it's becoming a much more radical, reactionary policy, and that is very much disconcerting. And two, what I find interesting is, you know, this Kufi, Christian United for Israel group, this Christian Zionist group, and how much they're connected to secular anti-Muslim groups, like, say, a Daniel Pipes and his Islamo-fascist awareness week and his website. And Daniel Pipes has been very clear that it's not just radical Muslims which are the problem. But it is anyone expressing an identity which he feels is outside of the Western identity must be shut down. So you have situations where even very moderate Muslims are trying to help create a secular Arab-speaking, Arab-teaching school, and Pipes sees, well, this is an idea of non-Western identity being expressed, and we must end this. And so there's a lot of very dangerous forces going on, and again, unity between secular anti-Muslim forces and religious anti-Muslim forces coming under the banner of being pro-Israel.
And just to add to that briefly, if you look at how the conference was structured, there were these panels at one of the days, which of course was closed to the press. And titles of those panels included Iran, Eye of the Storm, Radical Islam in their own words, and How to Stop Funding the Enemy, Divestment, Sanctions, and Boycotts. And Daniel Pipes, in fact, was a speaker at one of the panels on confronting the Islamofascists. And what's so telling is that you didn't have a panel called Let's Make Peace Between Israel and Her Neighbors 101, for example. You didn't get that. So right there, that sort of set the tone, if you will, for how the conference was going to go, for what Kufi attendees from across the U.S., what kind of information they were going to receive. And of course, for us, we watched as many of the Kufi goers were applauding and sometimes raising their hands in the air after the speakers said that the U.S. should only be on the side of Israel, for example, or that Ahmadinejad was a madman. You could see the response and the support based on the response from the audience.
And finally, I wanted to end with a question for both of you, and we'll begin with Diedrich. What have you taken away from this conference after encountering so much Arab and Muslim bashing on the part of the speakers, as well as just as Farah has just now said, that now these participants are going back out into their communities having more distorted propaganda in their hands in order to disseminate to people who don't really know about our religion and about our community, in order to further say that we are essentially what they described us as terrorists? What do you get out of this conference after hearing all this?
Well, one thing I find interesting I get out of this conference is a growing critique of secular leftist movements. And in that, it is quite clear to me that secular right-wing movements are willing to come together with religious right-wing movements to push forth a common cause. And part of this common cause is anti-Muslim and really anti-anything white or Western identity. And you tie in Pat Buchanan and other people, and even Daniel Pipes, about anti-immigration with Latinos and worries about black radicalism and all of these things. And there must be, for secular leftist groups, an understanding that religious communities aren't something to hold yourself above, but groups that must be engaged, that can have powerful influences on policy. And they need to do a better job in reaching out to the Muslim community. Muslim community needs to do a better job reaching out to secular leftist forces. But as well, secular leftist groups need to reach out, do a better job of reaching out to a lot of these Christians who really don't hear politics outside of the church. And we must, we must have better unity because those who are and against our interests are finding a greater unity.
And for, I agree. And for me, I think one of the main things I got out of it, again, is that we who are interested in truly promoting peace in the region, peace meaning, justice, especially between Israel, Palestine, between Israel and Arab neighbors. If we're really interested in promoting that, obviously Kufi is not that type of organization. What we really need is a movement of all people, as specifically Muslims, Jews, Christians, all people, all faiths coming together, instead of what we witnessed at Kufi, which was misinformation after misinformation. And there is a lot of work that needs to be done, but I particularly felt I had to be there. Post 9/11, civil liberties have definitely eroded for Muslims in America, for Arabs, for members of the South Asian community. And we have a lot of work ahead of us. We have a lot of work specifically piercing this myth that there can only be peace and security for Israel alone. And that's something that I'm more motivated to doing and looking into after being at Kufi.
Our guests today have been Farah Hassan, the 2008 Carol Jean and Edward F. Newman Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Diedrich Muhammad, the Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. In addition, they both contribute to Foreign Policy in Focus and are practicing Muslims. Farah Hassan and Diedrich Muhammad, we appreciate your work and thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer Ghassan Banura, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Naji Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.